Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Detroit, Michigan, and earned an MD in medicine from Wayne State University School of Medicine. He's a pioneer in the creation of healthcare systems throughout America. From 2006 to 2015, he was a physician executive of Oakwood Healthcare, and since 2021, he's been the executive director of the Southeast Michigan Continuing Medicine Education Consortium. His name? Dr. Michael Gahabe. And I'm Jack Grisullo, and this is Anything is Possible on 760 WJR. I'm Jack Grisullo. This is Anything is Possible. And we're talking to Dr. Michael Gahabe, a pioneer in the creation of healthcare systems throughout America. Doctor, welcome. An honor to have you.
Thank you, Jack. It's an honor to be here.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad, please?
Thank you, Jack, for asking that question. I grew up in Northwest Detroit. And as a kid, I'm the oldest of six kids. And as a kid, I was playing the piano in the basement, and my parents noticed that I was playing, and it wasn't all noise. I went to Presentation Grade School in Northwest Detroit, and they talked to the organist. He said, yeah, the kid knows how to play. You got to get him real lessons. And he recommended that I go to the Palestrina Institute of Music, which was founded by the Archdiocese to train church musicians. And they had attracted an unbelievable faculty, many of them misplaced musicians from the Second World War. My organ teacher was Lodi Van Dessel, and Van Dessel had been the head of the Lemons Institute and came to America and was the organist at St. Aloysius Church. So I played the organ at Presentation. I played the piano when I went to Catholic Central High School for the Glee Club. And when I went to the University of Detroit undergraduate, I was the organist at the Cathedral Church here in Detroit, Blessed Sacrament Cathedral. My parents said education is what you had to have, and they insisted that each of their six children just keep going until they could get as educated as they could be.
What's the biggest thing you learned from mom, and what's the biggest thing you learned from dad?
What I learned from my mother was work hard, be smart, and be tolerant. Understand other people. What I learned from my father was know the math, do the work, and always consider the other individual's perspective when, in fact, you are talking to them and trying to develop a relationship with them.
All right. It's obvious you had a huge passion for music. How did you go from music to being a physician? Why did you choose your ministry as a physician?
So, my parents, my father was doing well financially. We moved out of our little Northwest Detroit bungalow into one of those beautiful homes in Jesu Parish, just north of Six Mile Road. And I wish I could tell you this was a totally value-driven decision. I looked around the neighborhood and I said, there aren't any church musicians living here. I see doctors and lawyers. I was a math and science kid, and I said, I think I'll go to medical school. So I went to the University of Detroit, and I would say that the individual there that had the most impact on me was Father Reginald Albright, who's still alive. And Father Albright, if he put his stamp of approval on you because you were smart, you were going to get into med school because he didn't write letters for kids who he didn't think could make it. So I was bored out of my mind. In my second year, and I was getting great grades, I went to Father Albright, and I said, Father Albright, I'd like to apply early. And he said, all right. He said, I think you got a shot. He wrote me the letter, and I got into Wayne State's medical school. So I was an early acceptance and never received an undergraduate degree and was able to go early. But I know for a fact it was the judgment that Dr. Albright made that, in fact, gave me that opportunity. I've always thought it was perhaps influenced by the fact that the Jesuits needed to have someone to play their high masses every morning, Monday through Saturday. They had three, from 6 basically to 8 o'clock. So you had about 40 minutes a shot. So they paid $1.50 a mass. So I said, I can do this. So I played all the masses. And I'm sure the Jesuits thought I was a holy person. I would like to think I was. I was playing the organ at the cathedral. But the $1.50 a mass made it worthwhile.
All right. Then you went to Penn University.
So I went to medical school at Wayne State and graduated. And through people who took an interest in me, and this is where I learned the importance of mentorship. Finding mentors who could guide you, who took an interest in you. And I found two mentors there, and it was Dr. Robert Mack and Dr. A. Martin Lerner. And I did my internship at Hutzel Hospital. I had spent my senior year at the University of California doing a research rotation at Cal Berkeley. And they said, kid, if you really want to pursue an academic career, you need to go someplace else. And they wrote letters to the University of Pennsylvania, and I was accepted. And being at Penn transformed the way I thought. Being at an institution like that transforms your thinking. I was very, very fortunate that my chair of medicine was Dr. Arnold Relman, who went on to be the legendary editor of the New England Journal. My program director was Dr. Sam Thier, who went on to be the CEO, founding CEO of what is now MGH Brigham, and was head of the National Academy of Medicine for several years. And you learned something when you sat down with those individuals 6 days a week and reviewed cases. You learned how they thought.
You said that it transformed how you thought.
Yes.
In what way?
It added a discipline and a framework. And basically, if you're taking care of patients, you had to gather the information from the patient, history and physical. You had to do the appropriate exam. And then the best of those teachers forced you to put your head into the perspective of the patient that you were taking care of. You could say, this is what I think you need. And you would have to talk to the patient and make a determination if this is something the patient could accept, if it was something difficult. And then you had to learn how to persuade for people to act in their own interest. And the discipline of that organization around those guiding principles really changed the way I thought. It also was a rigorous, rigorous program. I was lucky that I did well in the program, and another individual whom you've interviewed and I were chosen to be the chief medical residents, Dr. Mark Kelly, who sends his regards, and I were the chief residents at the University of Pennsylvania and had a year, which was also interesting, learning how you corral people and get people to act in their own interest.
We referred to him as the good doctor. He was on JR many times with Paul W. through the years. So
Dr. Mark Kelly is a remarkable human being, and he's happy and well in Boston. We talked to him 2 weeks ago.
We're talking to Dr. Michael Gehabe, who's also a phenomenal human being. And when we come back, we're going to talk to him about his 20-year career as a practicing physician. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasula, and we're with Dr. Michael Gehabe, who was a physician executive who had responsibility for 7 hospitals, 3 academic health systems, and 5 physician practice groups. But for 20 years, you were a practicing physician focusing on critical care medicine. Talk about that chapter of your life.
Mm-hmm. So that chapter of my life, after I came back from the University of Pennsylvania, I was recruited to be the program director in internal medicine at Wayne State University. And I had the great good fortune to meet Dr. Richard Carlson, who was one of the pioneers of the modern field of critical care internal medicine. And Dick was the chief of medicine at the Detroit Receiving Hospital, and built one of the really, at that time, premier groups in critical care, which was a new field at that time. And my interest had been in kidney disease and fluid and electrolyte balance. And when people get really sick, your fluid and electrolytes are a mess. They go out of kilter. And one of the ways that you have to be able to get people out of that illness is managing their metabolic state. And so that's an area that I had particular interest in. I brought the principles to the training programs at Wayne State that I had learned at the University of Pennsylvania. So we revised that curriculum and got the faculty on board. I had the great honor of working for Dr. Venutis Vaitkevicius, who was the chair of medicine at the time, who was the founder of the Cancer Center here in town.
Dr. V.
And he agreed. He said, let's do it the way they did it at Penn. And we were to take kind of a scraggly program. And in a period of over a period of five years, I moved the American Board of Internal Medicine pass rate from under 50% to 95%. So it worked. The kids became disciplined, and they liked it. They began to think differently. And I had the fun of being a critical care physician, learning my craft at Detroit Receiving Hospital with Dick Carlson. Dick and I published the first major textbook in internal medicine for critical care, and we then edited for several years the a series on critical care that was published monthly. So that was a wonderful part of my life in medicine. Now, I was a math and science kid. Fluid and electrolytes are all numbers when you measure the serum sodium, the measure of the serum potassium. And I began to get interested in kind of financial modeling. And I took a look at the way you run health groups or health systems, kind of like you run your body. If you're a little edematous and have too much sodium, that's not good for the finances. If you're running right and you can figure out the compartments that all these things were in, whether it was the practice group or it was the hospital, you could begin to put together some financial modeling. So I developed a model based on funds flow analyses that began to take a look at how places were organized. And it turned out to hit the mark. It was a new way of looking at using my critical care and renal background to figure out the finances of health systems.
We're talking to Dr. Michael Gehabe. Doctor, you've been around thousands of doctors.
Yeah.
Worked with them, led them. What do all great doctors have in common?
What all great physicians have in common is they put the patients first. Everything else follows. And if you do that right, and you can do that in a balanced way, because it's hard to do given the practice of modern medicine, you'll get your practice right. The challenge of doing that are all the stressors that are currently in healthcare. Keeping the physician well is a major, major national discussion right now, both within the medical profession and actually now within the National Academy of Medicine. So put the patient first and figure out how you can keep yourself well when you take care of them.
You had a 20-year career as a practicing physician.
Mm-hmm.
World class. Then in the mid-90s, you quit practicing and you go into administration. Paint for us a picture of how a typical hospital ran back in the mid-90s.
A typical hospital ran in the mid-90s as a standalone, as I take a look at the great Henry Ford Hospital out the window, institution where patients came and they were seen and they had procedures. And the hospital was the focus of the clinical practice. You got sick, you went to the hospital. And if you were fortunate, you ended up at a hospital like the Henry Ford Health System. And there are many other good ones in this region, but I'm looking at that one right now. So it was by and large, and certainly in the field I was in critical care medicine, was entirely hospital-focused. We didn't have critical care outpatient series. You know, if you got out of the ICU, we got you to the right doctor so they could see you and follow you up. So that's what it looked like in the 90s. It's changed radically now.
We're talking to Dr. Michael Cahabe, who was a pioneer in the creation of healthcare systems. What caused all of this consolidation?
It's always the money. And it was also, as medicine became more developed and technologies advanced, you didn't have to do everything in the hospital. So if I take a look at an example, let's take a look at joint replacement, which was a very new field back in the 90s and was just getting started. And then it moved ahead and after the year 2000. And it used to be, and my wonderful wife is a good example of this, when her first joint was replaced, she spent a week in the hospital. Wonderful, fabulous surgeon. Replaced that joint. She had inpatient rehab, and the whole thing had to be done to make sure that that joint went in and it fit right, and you got her up and going, and nothing came out. Fast forward today, knee replacements are outpatient procedures. So the technology has shifted. What you can do in the ambulatory setting safely and better has virtually moved through every specialty field. So certainly a very large proportion, and perhaps the majority of care now is provided in the outpatient setting. And it's done safely and well. And you avoid the risks of being in the hospital. The sickest of the sick are in the hospitals. The worst infections are there because you couldn't take care of them in the office. And so patient safety and maintaining patient safety in these environments is a constant. You have to work at it every particular day. But in fact, hospitals are now very high acuity places to get your care. You really don't get admitted to the hospital unless you really are very sick.
We're talking to Dr. Michael Cahabe, and I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula. We're with Dr. Michael Cahabe. Doctor, two hospitals decide to merge. Mm-hmm. The easy thing is figuring out the numbers, figuring out all the legal issues, the document. But then somebody's got to bring these two families together. How do you do it?
Jack, you're hitting the hardest issue. With when these mergers occur, the question is: there a culture match and is there a mission match? I mentioned earlier, medicine is my mission. Not all health systems have the same mission. So can you sit down on a piece of paper, and can you say how patients come first, where that falls in your priority phase, and how you begin to approach it, and what your actual value systems are. I'll give you an example. We went through another individual who you, you've interviewed both, I think, Jerry Fitzgerald and Brian Connolly. Okay, those were
and Father Hasler too, George Hasler.
And George Hasler, George Hasler helped us build the culture at Oakwood, and we worked through a very long period of time where we had to build from the ground up a belief system. And that belief system was based upon the Oakwood Credo: compassion, respect, excellence, diversity, and ownership. I remember it today. And each one of those had line items of behaviors. And when we had embedded that into the culture, in terms of recruitment, you know, we were kind of on low end of the totem pole down in Dearborn trying to recruit people, and we had to kind of get what we could take, And when we developed the Oakwood Credo and the word spread, we had more applicants for those jobs than we could count. And we could recruit superb people because they believed in the Oakwood Credo. And every day when you'd start every meeting, whether you started at the board, whether it started at the executive meeting, or you're meeting on the floor with your nurses making rounds, you started by reciting the Oakwood Credo. So it's the belief system that counts. And I think that when you take two organizations and you can say, yeah, we can put that together and therefore the cultures will match, then you're going to have a very good outcome. But it really depends upon making that commitment up front. And to me, that's part of the basics of what you do. And if you don't follow those basics, you have difficulty with the merger. And if you do follow the basics, none of these are ever easy, then one must remember it's something you have to work at extraordinarily actively, because as I learned, negative cultures prevail unless you actively work at a positive culture.
All right. You and your wife, your oldest son, Michael, special needs.
Yes.
And you mentioned Jerry Fitzgerald of Oakwood. Iconic.
Yeah.
He and his wife also had a son, special needs.
Mm-hmm.
And the two of you, or the four of you, were instrumental in starting Eaton Academy,
mm-hmm.
I believe in 1986, 26 years ago. Talk to us about Eaton Academy.
So when Ginny and I moved back from Pennsylvania, and we moved back to the Detroit area, and we had a special needs kid, we enrolled him at the Adventure School, which was the only school for kids like this in the state. And the Fitzgeralds had enrolled their son, Tom. That's where we met them. We became best friends. We realized that this school needed to have a resource base. It needed to have a permanent home. And it needed to have a stable management infrastructure dedicated to that mission. So with that, Jerry, in his typical fashion, went out and bought the old school on Eaton Avenue, the old Catholic school there, and said, okay, we got a school now. And Jerry was the first chair of the Eaton Academy board. And after a surgery that I'd had, and I was really feeling not up to it, is Jenny put me in a car and we went down to Jerry's office. And at that point in time, Jerry said to me, well, as he would, as Jerry was good at, he said, I'm going to step out of the Eaton Academy board. And they looked at me and said, you're the next chair of the board. And I said, you get you while someone's down and you can't say no. That is a true story. But we started that and we put together a board of individuals. And principally, it was, I would say, the recruitment of Jenny and others who recognized the community need for this. And so we could put together a group of people who said, we need this in our community. That included originally Pat Hartman from ZBART, Julie Honigman-Levy, Nancy Vlasic, and very, very importantly, Mr. Mort Harris.
Let's go. Okay, we're looking out the window to West Grand Boulevard. You got Henry Ford Hospital on the right, but on the left is the Brigida Harris Cancer Institute.
Yes.
$25 million donation from Mort in her honor. He was an angel for you guys, like he was an angel for so many. Tell us about Mort Harris.
I can't say that Mort was like a best friend, but Mort was a man who could look forward and knew a community need when he saw it. And he was a man of action. And would try to make sure that happened. And the action that turned it around for us for Eaton Academy was we decided we would make a Kresge Foundation grant application. And we're frankly told, sorry, we don't do things like this. Kresge only does bigger things, and we don't give out grants to folks like that. We wrote a $1 million grant, and I was talking to Mort, and I said, we can't get through the door. And Mort said, Well, make an appointment, and you know, just go make an appointment. And we did that with the new headmistress, and he said, I'll go with you. So we went there. We met with the head of the Kresge Foundation at that time, and we presented our case. And he said, you have a good case, but we don't do this. But I'm here today because you're here with Mr. Mort Harris, and he said this is worthy. He said, write the application for the grant, send it to me directly. We got $1 million. And that's how we started our capital campaign. Thank you, Mr. Harris. Good for the community.
He gave $25 million to Henry Ford. That's the largest gift Henry Ford ever got. He also gave $10 million to Wayne State University and the School of Medicine, full of scholarships for inner-city kids who want to become doctors.
Yes.
At his funeral a little more than a year ago, died at 101, there were like 20 of these physicians and kids who have become doctors because of Mort Harris. A mensch.
To say the least.
All right. Whenever I've had somebody on the show that's had a special needs child, doctor, they refer to those people as their angel, their hero, their teacher, their gift from God. Why?
Well, that's a great question. Because, you know, you go through all the ups and downs with these kids. And our son has surprised us every step of the way. One of the biggest surprises was when I moved to Alabama. I was the founding CEO of the University of Alabama at Birmingham Health System. Our son was going to, Jenny found a very good school in Iowa for him to go, that for special needs kids. So he went there, and at his graduation at 2 years, I got all upset because I looked in I looked at the graduates, and he wasn't there in that program. Turns out he moved into the regular line because he was able to do that. And then at that time, I had a good friend who was the president of the University of Alabama. I was working there, and he said, "We're trying to set up programs for kids like this." He said, "Let us have a crack at him." So he went to the University of Alabama after that. And every time he's surprised. He never passed math, by the way, so they waived the math requirement. He doesn't do math.
Like you don't do dishes, I think.
Like I don't do. No, I actually.
All right.
My wife's Italian. There are prices to pay. And
like you don't listen. Okay. I'm sorry.
That's selective at home. And he graduated in 4 years, and his mother earned that degree with him, but he did. So he continually surprised, and he lives with us, and. You know, and he's got two other siblings who are high achievers and from a career and from a whole variety of other reasons. And he's a high achiever, and he knows it. He works at Ford Motor Company, and he's very thoughtful, has a great deal of insight into people, into circumstances. And the joy of the conversations with him I have every day, one of the best parts of my life.
We're talking to Dr. Michael Gahabe, a proud papa. And I'm Jack Rasula. And this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR.
Jack Rasula, host of WJR's Anything Is Possible, the weekly radio visit, brings his 15 years of inspirational storytelling to hardcover. With God, anything is possible.
Anything is possible.
15 of Jack's more than 750 tales of defeating odds and achieving the extraordinary. Like Bob Woodruff, whose job covering the war in Iraq nearly cost him his life. And Nick Vujicic, the limbless evangelist who has stunned millions with his message of acceptance and grace. With God, anything is possible. Order now while signed copies are still available at trustinusllc.square.site. That's trustinusllc.square.site. And as Jack says,
make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spohol.
Anything is possible.
I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Dr. Michael Gahabe, a pioneer in the creation of healthcare systems throughout America. How did music, your love for music and the organ, prepare you to be a physician?
Well, Jack, first of all, you had to learn the score. You had a score in front of you. You had to practice, learn the score. The score was your plan. So in business, you have to have a plan, and I had a score. And I was interested in conducting, so that's what my major interest was after playing. So I conducted choirs and orchestras. And you got to get on same pitch, same score, on time, and sing it right and play it right. That's a health system. Know the score, same pitch, on time, make it all come together and be symphonic. So when you take a look at a score, and there's 17 to 30 different lines, and there's different cadences, and there's different music for every line, that's like dealing with the surgeons, or dealing with the internists, or dealing with the neurologists, dealing with the administrators or finance people. Are you on the same score? Are you on the same page? And do you know your line?
Your wife, Ginny's a great singer. And one day she says, I got a new score for us. There's this young girl, Christine. She's an opera singer. I think we should help her.
Well, we were at Stony Brook at the time, which has a fine music school. And Ginny said, you got to hear this kid. I went and heard the kid. She was unbelievable. And we talked to her teacher at that time and said, she's unbelievable. And a couple of days later, there was the person at the box office called Ginny and said, if you have an interest in this, she's in trouble. She can't keep going. She's got no money. So we helped her out, wrote the check, put her back in school. And 2 weeks later, she came to say thank you. And Ginny noticed in the car that, you know, she had her bags and stuff like that. She said, well, right now I'm looking for a place to live. And Ginny said, well, move in. She did, and she never left. Today, Christine is recognized as the great dramatic voice in the world. The Metropolitan Opera revived its Wagner Ring cycle for her Brunhilde. That says it all. And she loves Michigan. She's currently Associate Artistic Director at Detroit Opera and did Brunhilde at this last thing that they put on. So she's still singing. She's still running around the world. She's still got the pipes. And you know, she's at a point where she's considering what else she will do. But right now, the voice is in good shape.
All right. Since 2021, Dr. Michael Gehabe has been the executive director of the Southeast Michigan Continuing Medicine Education Consortium. Talk about that chapter.
So this is the second time I failed retirement. And a very good friend, whom you may know, Dr. Mark Usich, who heads Kresge Eye Institute, called me up and said, SEMCME needs an executive director, and you would do a great job. And I said, I wasn't looking for a job. He said, I didn't say that. I said, you would do a good job. So I said, okay, Mark, let's do it. And so I was interviewed, as I should have been, and they asked me to do the job. I'll be 2 years into it, and it's marvelous. It's six health systems, the six major health systems, are all members of this organization, and it focuses on their residents, graduate medical education. And if you take a look at the depth of talent in this community among these six health systems, and you bring some of that together to educate their kids, it's remarkable. It's the largest consortium like of this type, I think. Certainly in the Midwest, it may be the largest consortium of its type in the country. And it keeps me out of my wife's hair.
When we had breakfast a few weeks ago, one of the most amazing statements you made to me was, and I quote you, Jack, we are losing more physicians to suicide than we are to retirement.
Yeah.
Really, Mike?
Jack, the pressures on the physician community have only increased over the last few years. And the major issues that they face is, I'm trying to practice medicine, but I'm spending more time with the electronic health record than I am with my patient. And I'm spending more time documenting things so the money comes in than I am with the patient. And so it's this has become a very large national issue now, and the National Academy of Medicine and the National Academy of Sciences just published within the last 2 weeks their national plan to how do you directly deal with really the epidemic of dealing with physician well-being and beginning to identify the factors that can focus on a practicing physician and allow them to spend their time with the patient and get a lot of the other pressures off their back.
We're talking to Dr. Michael Gehabe. If you want to learn more about his latest venture, www.SEMCME.org. SEMCME.org. Mm-hmm. All right. The lack of nurses and the job that our nurses have done these last almost 3 years.
So, Jack, the National Academy of Medicine also recognizes it ain't just physicians that we're talking about. It's everyone working in the field. And to your point, the pressure on nurses is horrendous. They're probably, I don't know the numbers, but they're probably burning out of the field faster than the docs are. I'm an intensivist, and for those nurses to come in and see a patient for 24 hours, 24/7 a day and have to hand that off and constantly communicate, you know, I would have the luxury, and the docs too. I make rounds that day. I may see them again in the afternoon. But who's with that patient 24/7? It's really the nursing staff. And it's been particularly difficult with COVID. And it ranges from emotions of fear, all the grief reactions, a lot of anger, especially around folks that refuse vaccination and are exposing both healthcare workers and others and their family to the dangers of COVID. And so, but you have to say that if you take a look, they've risen to the occasion, they've managed all those emotions, but it doesn't mean that we shouldn't pay attention to it and figure out how we can make their work lives better.
Dr. Michael Gehabe, thanks for all you've done. Thanks for all you continue to do. Ginny doesn't want you home for lunch. Keep up the great work. Please join us next Saturday. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spahn.
Believe in yourself.